Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republicans' frantic search for ways to pay for tax cuts as last-minute holdouts like Senator Rubio demand concessions in the tax bill that is expected to be finalized on Friday and voted on next week. Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, who was the chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, whose latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, joins us. We'll discuss how the Republicans are rushing the bill through without independent scoring and any consultation with Democrats to get it passed and on Trump's desk before the new Democratic Senator Doug Jones is sworn in. And even then, with Senator Corker remaining a no vote and Senators McCain and Cochran hospitalized due to the Republicans' narrow majority in the Senate, Vice President Pence, who would break a tie vote, has had to delay an overseas trip, indicating the vote in the Senate is on shaky ground. Then we'll examine the blow to internet freedom resulting from the 3-2 vote today by the FCC to overturn net neutrality in a victory for a few corporate monopolies at the expense of broad democratic opposition from consumers who will soon find that their internet will be like their cable TV service, a poverty of choice in a rigged market where Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T foist their content on you while slowing down or blocking the content you want. David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, where he explores the intersection between media design, culture, policy, and journalism, joins us to discuss how Rupert Murdoch is likely to use the $52 billion from the sale of his entertainment assets to Disney to boost Fox News and expand the number of local TV stations Fox has. Then finally, we'll look further into the killing of net neutrality by the FCC chair and explore Ajit Pai's ties to movement conservatives following his appearance in a video produced by the Daily Caller that mocks supporters of net neutrality and features Pai dancing with the producer with the Daily Caller who promoted the Pizzagate conspiracy. Victor Picard, a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform, joins us to discuss whether a corporate hireling will get away with thwarting the will of the people. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at The Hill, Senators Picked Americans' Pockets Via Degraded Tax Policy Process. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Ian, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ed. And this is a pretty down-to-the-wire, I would think, at this last minute, since they're hoping to get the two House and Senate bills finally merged tomorrow, Friday, where you've got Senator Rubio now wanting to expand child tax credits, along with Mike Lee of Utah. Obviously, they've got leverage. It may strike some as extortion, but its purpose actually is quite virtuous. But then you've also got Senator Ron Johnson saying, we're literally trying to squeeze about $2 trillion in tax reform into a $1.5 trillion box, and that's been a problem. Is that it in a nutshell?
Well, yes, that really is it in a nutshell. The bill is a very large, a permanent tax cut for corporations, for businesses conducted in so-called pass-through form, like partnerships and limited liability companies, and for very, very wealthy individuals who have the good fortune to die with multi-million dollar estates. Those are very expensive propositions and need to be paid for. And in order to come within the Congress's own rules for this particular bill, that they will squander no more than $1.5 trillion in this legislation. And so they've got a lot of squeezing to do. Obviously, one of the principal ways they've done that so far is by terminating all of the individual tax cuts that, in fact, help the middle class to some extent. Those all expire, And at the same time, the tax brackets in which people's income falls, so the tax rates they pay, creeps up more quickly than current law. So the result is when those expire, people will be paying more tax than they are today.
Well, there's even talk of having these tax cuts for individuals expiring even sooner than the 2025 date. And of course, the tax cuts for corporations and for the highest earners, they've both been reduced, corporate tax from 35 to 21 now, and then the top bracket for the 1%, if you will, is what, 39.5 down to 37, is that right?
Yeah, 39.6 down to 37, but I don't treat any number as final at this point. They have a hard ceiling of the $1.5 trillion, and there's going to be horse trading going, I believe, well into the night on Friday to hit that. The nonpartisan staff, the Joint Committee on Taxation, where I used to work, are the people whose job it is to score all of these moving pieces and tell Congress whether they've gone over their self-imposed ceiling or not. That's an iterative process, and every change takes the JCT staff, you know, some time to run through their computer models. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be an early day on Friday for Congress of the United States. There are some of these moving parts we ought to keep an eye on. One is this idea of shortening still further the time frame in which individuals would get a tax cut while leaving this creep in the tax rate brackets in place. You know, that just confirms in a conspicuous way what Mark Meadows, of all people, said very clearly last week, which is...
Right, he's the Tea Party guy, right?
Yes, yes. He's the sort of the head of the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus, it's now called. It's graduated to being the Freedom Caucus. He said, look, this is a giant corporate tax cut that we are marketing as a middle-class tax cut. Very candid statement that's basically correct. And so if they were so foolish as to cut back the individual tax cuts in the terms of the number of years to which they apply, it just confirms that that statement as the right way to understand the legislation. I do think that there is a significant possibility that the 21% corporate rate will suddenly creep up to 22%. I mean, that's if you're Mitch McConnell, what you want to do is you've already had the president signal that he would be thrilled with that. You want to do that late Friday night and say, I tried my best, but the numbers just don't work. We have to do this to get this passed. What are you going to do about it, corporations? You're still so much better off than you are under current law that you would have a hell of a lot of gall to complain about this this result. So it would not surprise me if that happened late Friday.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbard, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at The Hill, Senators Picked Americans' Pocket via Degraded Tax Policy Process. But it's pretty clear that this is a bill for the donors, and the problem the Republicans have is they've got to sell what the giveaway to the donors to their voters and con their voters into believing that this is a middle-class tax cut. And as they make more and more compromises in the last minutes, except for the compromise with Rubio, which is actually to help children, by and large, what is your feeling that they're going to screw the middle class further?
No, I don't, except for shortening the time frame, which
right.
obviously is
right.
screwing. I don't think there'll be new provisions aimed at taking more away. They've already added back the alternative minimum tax for individuals, mm-hmm. which undercuts people who are in business, who are claiming lots of what's called accelerated depreciation deductions, that is, claiming deductions for the wear and tear on business investments at very accelerated rates relative to economic actual wear and tear. So there are places where they can tweak some dials there, for example, because they put back the individual AMT, not the corporate. They could lower the income level at which the AMT, the new AMT for individuals would apply. That raises revenue. But beyond that and shortening the time frame, I don't think they have a lot of knobs or dials to turn on the individual side to raise a lot of revenue.
Well, obviously they want to get this thing done before the Democratic Senator Doug Jones, who was just elected from Alabama, the president wants this signed by Christmas. Yes. Senator Cork is still a no vote. And as I mentioned, Senator McCain and Cochran are both hospitalized. We don't know the extent to which Senator McCain, he obviously has a serious brain cancer. And we just learned that Vice President Pence, who would break the tie vote, has delayed an overseas trip. So I guess there's an imperative to pass it because the Republicans just simply can't look as if they can't get anything done. On the other hand, this is not a done deal. So do you think that this is, at the end of the day, in spite of this last-minute extortion, if you will, they're going to pass this thing? It sounds like they don't have enough votes. And I don't, if you can only afford to lose two, you've already lost one with Corker. And then you've got McCain and Cochran hospitalized.
Right. You can afford to lose a total of three.
Three. I see. Okay.
Because of the tie vote goes to the vice president. Yeah. But I do think it happens. I think it will happen by a whisker. What Senator Rubio is doing is actually good for the lowest income Americans. A stop clock that's right twice a day, just because he's a Republican doesn't mean that every idea he has is necessarily bad. Mm-hmm. This is actually a desirable, from the point of view of the country, a desirable point that he's trying to force.
Let's go through what's still in it, though, that sure. For example, here in this blue state of California, we're being punished politically, it would seem, losing the ability to deduct state and local taxes. And also, it's pretty galling that Chairman Brady of the House Ways and Means Committee, who's from Houston, has made sure that victims of the hurricanes in Florida and in Texas get to deduct their losses, but victims of fires in California don't. So there seems to be a double standard at play here.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. In the end, the deal is $10,000 of state and local tax deductions, whether property tax or income tax or both. $10,000, unfortunately, does not go a long way in California or New York for the sum of property tax and income taxes. It is really, quite unfair if what you're trying to do is come up with national legislation that is fair to all income groups all across the country. It is a troubling provision to have added, but that's going to be the deal, $10,000 of total state and local.
Well, what about I can't understand why we're not investing in students as opposed to making them centers of profit. You know, the students used to be able to deduct student loans. They can't do that anymore. And there's this horrible provision in the House bill. The PhD students have to quadruple their taxes. Is that still in there?
My understanding is that drops out. My understanding is that the Senate has prevailed on that point. But it was such a conspicuously bad idea that it's really quite difficult to understand what went through people's heads. It's very simple. Take a big step back. There are only two ways that factors that go into our national income. One is labor, our own personal effort, and the other is the capital that creates the machines and the intangible assets that individuals put to work. Well, two-thirds of our income comes from labor. So what you really want is to change the growth path of the U.S. economy, to just bump us up to a higher growth path. Well, then the logical thing to say is, how can we make the biggest asset class in the United States more productive? And that asset class is human beings themselves and their labor. So where we should be going is doing everything we can to lower the cost of higher education, not to raise it, and to create more opportunities for bright kids of limited means. That's how you address long-term inequality. That's how you address the stagnation through which lower-income Americans find it harder and harder to change their lives from one generation to the next. That's how you put the United States on a higher growth path, and yet that idea is completely foreign to the current Congress, and I think we know the reason, which is that the current Congress views the university in general as its enemy. They view it as a hotbed of liberal democratic ideas, rather than viewing the university as one of the great achievements of the United States. To have public universities of the quality that we do in California is really one of the great accomplishments of this country. And that's exactly right, Ian, that's where we ought to be investing.
Well, just in the last minute then, Ed, some analysts say that there'll be a temporary bump. There'll be a feel-good temporarily, and then the bad stuff's going to happen later. And not before long, people will be actually realizing how much this thing's going to hurt them. Is that your understanding that, how long before people recognize that this is a bad deal?
First, it's not at all clear that people will necessarily recognize it's a good deal, because it doesn't translate into your take-home pay immediately. You've got to change your withholding for 2018. That's itself a process that employers have to initiate. It's going to take months to get done. Then you have to remember that the income tax for people making, say, under $75,000 or even $100,000 a year, the biggest tax they pay is the payroll tax, and that's not changing. So we're changing one component of the tax system, not every component. And finally, what's going to happen is that, and we've already heard this from some early sort of gun jumpers like Paul Ryan himself, that as soon as the ink is dry on this, they're going to move to start cutting back benefits, because what choice do they have? Our deficits have increased. Well, they just increased our deficits, and so what that will then be used as a tourniquet to reduce government spending and investment, and that spending and investment hits lower-income Americans and the middle class hardest. So this is really a very pernicious piece of legislation when you remember not just how the tax benefits are being distributed, but what will happen by way of turning that tourniquet to insist that spending must now be cut because, geez, what do you know? All of a sudden there are deficits.
Well, Edward Kleinbaum, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbaum, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He served as the chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at The Hill, Senators Picked America's Pockets Via Degraded Tax Policy Process. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the blow to internet freedom resulting from the 3-2 vote today by the FCC to overturn net neutrality. Ain't got but the blood for a lot of folks. But I ain't one. From now on, keep up my pay. Ain't gonna need a gun. Take the 1044s and shove them. Straighten out their own damn mess. You can write me off, cause I ain't giving a dime to the IRA. Deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise up.
laws. Yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swag's the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But who do you think you are?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
It's good to be back on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, David. And it seems like we've gotten a 1-2 punch here today with the killing of net neutrality by Ajit Pai and the three Republicans on the FCC, who, of course, outvoted the two Democrats. But also the merger between, the purchase of Fox's entertainment assets by Disney in a $52.4 billion holiday shopping spree has basically... I can't help feeling that there's a sort of connection here in a way between the end of net neutrality and the further consolidation of media monopolies.
Yes, I would agree. It's a unsurprising but depressing turn of events for the sake of consumers and consumer protection. But there is a tremendous pressure in the media and telecommunications industry to compete with the immense power of Facebook and Google. And so this action today, whether it be the repeal of the net neutrality rule and the merger or acquisition of 21st Century Fox by Disney, the push towards consolidation and the further deregulation of rules in this business has all been justified generally to give these businesses more leverage to compete with what we call in the business the duopoly, the two companies that are capturing the vast majority of advertising revenue and the attention of consumers around the world.
But isn't this a move, in effect, to particularly Disney obviously wants to compete in terms of streaming video with Netflix and Amazon? But in general, if they control the pipe into the home and they also control the content, is that their way of fighting back against Facebook and Google? Explain how the mechanics of this could work to the advantage of the sort of latecomers, if you will.
Sure, yes, indeed. It really is the sort of old legacy industry competing with the new industry, whether it be Google, Facebook, or Amazon, Netflix. And so in order to do this, they can leverage their existing infrastructure, which is the media properties as well as the channels into people's home. And so if we imagine the worst-case scenario of what repealing net neutrality could do, it could create what we could imagine as a tiered internet where you sort of buy access on an a la carte basis to different services, and that would, of course, advantage different things on top of others. So, for example, you might have a base package, and then you would pay an additional fee to get Netflix, and then an additional fee to get Amazon, and an additional fee to make your Facebook load faster, and so on. The companies would be free to do this where they are prohibited from doing so under the current or former rule set. And so the fear is that there would be tremendous business incentives for all the companies to do this. And we see this already happening with people's mobile providers. That is, certain companies are given preferential access in what's called zero rating. For example, you might get HBO stream for free where it doesn't count towards your data bill, and that's a special deal that was made. And consumers seem to like this, but they don't understand the broader impact of advantaging one company over the other and the way that the telecom providers and the cable companies will be the ones who will pick the winners. And so it theoretically could eliminate some of the open-ended innovation that got us here in the first place, that any new player could come along and offer a new product or service that consumers would adopt, and there was a level playing field to accomplish that success. In a post-net neutrality world, you're going to need to strike a deal with Verizon, Comcast, or AT&T.
And again, I'm speaking with David Carroll, who's professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad techs, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Now, in terms of the latter, journalism, I don't see any wins here. I think that Disney will probably downsize ABC News. And now that Rupert Murdoch has $52.4 billion to play with, having sold his entertainment assets to Disney, my understanding is he's likely to invest in expanding Fox News and buying more local stations. He got kind of beaten out by Sinclair, and they outbid him, but apparently he's looking at other stations. I think he's got about 28 that he owns already, and I think there's another 88 that he's trying to get from ION, I believe it's called. So what do you think Murdoch is up to, since he's clearly gotten tired of the entertainment business, and now I don't imagine he's just going to retire on $52 billion, is he?
Well, it's been reported that the president reached out to Mr. Murdoch and made sure that Fox News was not part of the deal, which is disturbing in its own right. The idea was to sell the entertainment assets when they were at their maximum value, especially up against the competition. And the deregulation related to not only net neutrality, but ownership rules in markets opens the floodgates, if you will, for further media ownership consolidation across different media, so owning newspapers and TV stations and so on. So these rules were put in place to prevent the scenarios that we fear, that is, single individuals owning access to information into individual households, whether it be cable, other media, or the internet itself. And so these rules were put in place for a reason, and it's really a bald-faced attempt to allow further consolidation of power, power not only in making money, but power in controlling information. And so even though it's a really esoteric, obscure kind of idea, the fact that so many Americans are so enthusiastically in favor of the net neutrality rules and were protesting at huge scale against the rules shows that people really do care about this. And even though it's a very technical concept, you could say that enough average Americans really understand what's at stake, which shows further how considerable the regulation regime of the FCC has been completely captured by the industry, and it doesn't serve in the public interest anymore. It serves in the private interest, and that is really troubling.
Well, I think if people understood that what's happening now is that the internet's going to be cableized. In other words, we all know how dreadful these cable companies are that have monopolies and control the pipe into your home and keep charging you more for less choice and have this kind of poverty of choice. And clearly, now that they're free to foist their content on you at the expense of what you want to find by slowing down or blocking what you want to find, that really changed the landscape. And I don't know that the proponents of net neutrality, a term in itself that's rather inadequate, really got the message across of what's at stake. Because I think anybody, I don't think there's one person on the planet who likes these cable monopolies.
Sure. And the degree to which the commissioners who supported the preservation of the rules received messages from citizens who were, you know, rejecting the change shows that this was only supported by the companies and the people that are paid to lobby for the companies. And the degree to which Commissioner Pai has had contempt for the American people is shocking. And the way that he's been caught on tape mocking us for being upset is just a sort of insult to injury, that they are, in a sense, proud to work only for the industry, and they're not even ashamed to mock us for caring about this. So we're really at a degree here where the monopolies not only control the choices that consumers have and will have, but control the government and its ability to regulate it. And this idea that these monopolies don't owe the taxpayers something is also preposterous, because their infrastructure was subsidized by the taxpayers and the government public property. So it's just this weird, troubling capture of what should be in the public interest. And if we don't have mechanisms to preserve the public interest, it's just going to fall to the plutocracy. And there's no other way to understand it. And the contempt for the public is just, it's flabbergasting.
Well, what explains that psychologically? I mean, you have this Ajit Pai character who is proud of the fact that he's a whore and hireling and lackey of big cable monopolies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, and that he has contempt for the public that he's supposed to serve on the FCC. I'm just trying to grapple with that idea of what kind of a human being this could be and what would make him tick, because he's a servant of the powerful. He's not a member of the club, is he? Or is he trying to get into the club?
I mean, he used to work for Jeff Sessions, and then he worked for Verizon. And today he appeared in a mocking video with the Pizzagate conspiracy theorist. So, you know, you just have to observe his conduct, and you can get a sense of who he wants to associate with. And they believe that small number of people should control this stuff, and they're not ashamed to say it. And they're not ashamed to be associated this way. So we just have to take them for what they are. It becomes really important for future elections. I think U.S. voters will care who future leaders will appoint as the FCC chair, because they understand the importance of the agency in their everyday lives.
So there's no stopping Rupert Murdoch, and obviously he's very close to Donald Trump. He's, in fact, the number one Trump whisperer. Apparently they talk often. And as you mentioned today, Donald Trump, his spokesman, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, mentioned that they had talked and Trump had congratulated Murdoch on the deal. And there is obviously a double standard. Trump hates CNN, so he's holding up the Time Warner merger at the same time giving his blessing to the Disney-Fox merger, which even has more antitrust implications, I think. So is that what's driving this? This is the personal peak of the powerful. If you're a favorite of Trump's, you get his blessing, and if you're an enemy, and by the way, he also hates Amazon, Jeff Bezos, and particularly the Washington Post. He's always going after him. So it sounds like, is that a factor here?
It's hard to discount that. And it makes it all the more troubling that the president is picking winners and losers, which is a talking point of the deregulators. So the just bald-faced hypocrisy here is troubling, and the rapid march toward things that we observe in autocratic regimes is also troubling. And so none of this is normal. And it is a wake-up call to all of us. And the subversion of the democratic process itself is also really troubling, in the sense that The public comment system is completely poisoned by what appears to be a massive bot-driven campaign to steal the identities of American citizens and post false comments into the system. And the Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, has been trying to get the FCC to cooperate in an investigation, and even a few Republican senators called upon the vote to be delayed today because of the subversion of the public comment system. And again, another example of just the contempt for the democratic process itself here is shocking. And on any normal set of circumstances, it would be entirely reasonable to pause and solve the problem of the subversion of the public comment engine. And we really are seeing the sort of effects of identity theft. So it's not just privacy and data issues related to the election, but even the policy process of public comment, that a million New Yorkers had their identities stolen and false comments made in their name. And yet it doesn't matter because our comments didn't matter in the first place anyway. The decision was already made. Chairman Pai's whole existence is to undo Chairman Wheeler's efforts. And it began in the beginning of the year with the repeal of the FCC broadband privacy rule, again, under the same pretense of deregulation, and again, the same arguments made by the industry that they need these deregulations to be put into place so that they can compete with Google and Facebook. So more consolidation of power to fight consolidation of power. And the American voter and consumer loses out each time.
And the companies that innovate get screwed, like Netflix, by these old companies that are kind of like the mafia. They just control the pipe, so they're just going to extort more money. That seems to be the way it is.
And
in terms of capitalism, this is pretty retrograde.
Yeah, it's really, we're dealing with antitrust in the same old way, and our philosophy and policy structure to deal with this is completely inadequate. And I think it's really a coming to terms of the consolidation of power in terms of private enterprise at the expense of the public. And people are mad about it, and the fight over net neutrality is really just beginning, and we should expect that some lawmakers will use the same rule that was used to repeal the FCC broadband privacy rule, the congressional review rule, to try to resolve the net neutrality issue. So the ball is really now in Congress's court, and then there's also discussion of the lawsuits that will be filed in the courts. So this doesn't end in the regulatory agency. It really is the beginning of a fight that will occur in Congress and in the courts. It's too important of an issue. People really care about it, and they're not going to give up on it. And as soon as you start to see the worst-case scenarios actually come true, then, you know, the resistance to these changes will be vindicated. And there's just so much economic incentive to tier the internet and to block and then charge more to extract more out of us. They say they're not going to do it, and then they change their tune as soon as they can. So they're this just trust us mantra has never worked in the past, so I don't understand why we should expect it to work in the future.
Well, David Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you, David. Again, I've been speaking with David Carroll, professor of media design at the New School and director of its Design and Technology MFA program, which explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. And his research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, who has been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the New America Foundation. And with Robert McChesney, he co-edited Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? His latest book is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Picard.
It's great to be back on the show, Ian.
Well, thank you, Victor. And the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, he won a 3-2 vote along party lines today before the FCC to kill net neutrality. He is apparently, I don't quite know, understand what makes him tick, except he's just a right-wing ideologue and a corporatist. I mean, he put out a YouTube video of himself dancing with a Pizzagate conspiracy theorist. This video was produced by the conservative outlet, The Daily Caller. So is this what this guy is then? Just a right-wing activist out of the Steve Bannon world, a part of this Trump tendency to put the wrecking crew in charge of government agencies, people who are dedicated to their destruction and opposed to the very mission of what these public agencies are about?
Well, I haven't seen the video that you mentioned, but I'll have to check that out. But yes, I think it's fair to say that this FCC under Chairman Pai's leadership is exhibiting a textbook case of regulatory capture. I mean, it's basically granting a longstanding wish list held by all the industries that this agency is meant to regulate. And this is very troubling. It's deeply undemocratic. Chairman Pai seems to be impervious to any sort of popular or democratic pressures. One of his main jobs is meant to be upholding the public interest. And everything he's done in the last 10 months seems to be the exact opposite of that.
Well, it's a bit of a coincidence, don't you think, Victor Picard, that on the day that net neutrality is overturned, we also learn about the Disney-Fox merger, which Donald Trump approves of because basically Rupert Murdoch whispers in his ear every day. I mean, they talk every day, and it's pretty clear that Fox has become the kind of Pravda of the Trump White House, and they're leading the charge now to get rid of their special counsel, Robert Mueller. So there's no disputing the close ties between Murdoch and Trump. But in contrast, of course, Trump's opposing the Time Warner merger with AT&T because he hates CNN and wants to punish them. So my understanding is that getting rid of net neutrality will basically help Disney, the new Disney Fox, put the competition like Netflix and Amazon out of business. And of course, Trump hates Amazon as well, as you know, because of their ownership of the Washington Post. So I see a kind of, just as we in this tax bill, they're punishing California for being a successful state, taking away Californians' ability to deduct state and local taxes, to raise their taxes. That's political vindictiveness. There seems to be an element of that going on as well.
That's true that the entire project that Trump rode to power on, this idea that he was going to drain the swamp, he was going to challenge corporate monopolies, I mean, it has just been shot through with contradictions. But at the regulatory agencies like the FCC, their operations have been fairly consistent. They have basically been doing everything that these industries want to see happen, whether it's allowing these media mergers to go through, whether it's stripping privacy protections, it's basically rewriting the rules to benefit single groups, companies like Sinclair Broadcast Group. They've actually been very ideologically consistent at the FCC, but this goes completely against what Donald Trump said he would do while he was a candidate for the presidency. One of his most popular lines at his rallies was that he was going to take on some of these media monopolies because they had too much power. I mean, he was actually adopting what sounded like almost a left-wing critique at times. But since assuming the presidency, there's been very little evidence of that kind of agenda, and instead we're seeing increased corporate power and less and less public interest regulations.
And again, I'm speaking with Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the Neuenberger Foundation. And with Robert McChesney, he co-edited Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? His latest book is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. So I don't want to give in to despair, Victor, because it seems that since Trump started to run for president, and then since he's been president, we've had a daily dose of doom. There was a bit of a reversal in terms of what happened in Alabama, where a good guy beat a really bad guy. But the bad guys have been winning, and this is another victory for the bad guys, at least the way I see it. What can the average citizen do now? Because we don't want our internet to end up like cable TV, which is the poverty of choice, endless price hikes, lousy service, no competition, and they foist their garbage on you, and you won't be able to get what you want. You'll be absolutely force-fed their content. And that's where we're heading. There's no two ways about it. What can citizens do?
Yes, so despite that very dystopian outlook, and I agree with you that the current trajectory is very depressing, and we want to change course as fast as we can. Despite this, I'm actually cautiously optimistic for the long term. The fight for net neutrality did not end with the FCC's decision. It's headed to the courts. We can still apply pressure on Congress. I think voters will remember this in upcoming elections. There will someday be a new FCC. I don't think people are going to give up easily on net neutrality, but the other long-term fight that we have to keep in focus is that we need to find ways to challenge these monopolies. In many ways, net neutrality is a symptom of a bigger problem, which is utter lack of competition in our local internet markets. We need to find ways where we build actual public alternatives. And I think community and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks is a structural alternative, is a public alternative, a public option that we're going to have to fight for the long term. Otherwise, we're going to be constantly fighting with these internet service providers over net neutrality.
Well, it was a pretty bitter vote, and the Democrats in the minority on the 3-2 vote, Minion Kleiban, for example, expressed her outrage. And by the way, security people came in and emptied the room of reporters before it took place at Pies.
I saw that.
Yeah. Which is, I think, just pure theater on Pi's part. Somehow the radical leftists are going to plant a bomb or some stupid thing like that. This is who these... I mean, this guy's a disgrace. I don't know where... I guess, you know, he's doing what his masters are paying him to do. I mean, I'm sure he's going to end up with a huge windfall or a golden parachute at some point or other. But one of the things that is outrageous about Pi's behavior, and we can't quite get to the bottom of it, although the Attorney General of the State of New York is looking into it. Apparently somebody has been tampering with the public comments on the FCC. And as you know, last time around, during the Obama administration, enormous amount of public outcry definitely contributed to the Obama administration's decision to preserve net neutrality. The same amount of outcry, apparently, if not more, is happening now as citizens notice and realize that net neutrality is about to end. The comment sections have been hijacked, and pro-corporate guys, you know, in other words, Pies people who are the hirelings of Comcast and Verizon, etc., they're apparently... Somebody is using the names of citizens of New York and other states and doing phony letters to the FCC in support of getting rid of net neutrality. What do you know about that, Victor?
Yes, well, I know that there have been a number of proven irregularities in this process, especially the fraudulent comments that you're referencing, and Chairman Pai has refused to investigate that. There have been, they think now, at least 2 million fake comments that were entered during this process, this comment period. But at the same time, what I think you're pointing to is the fact that despite all that, there have been millions and millions of people who have written in advocating for net neutrality. And I think this stands testament to this public engagement. People are really engaged and aware of this issue. And I don't think they're just going to give up on it. I think they're going to continue to fight for net neutrality.
So if this is all about corporate power and having their lackey as the head of the FCC, what about then other corporate power? I mean, it's the same argument you can have for example, global warming. The oil companies are causing global warming, but maybe we should ally ourselves with the insurance company because they got skin in the game and they're all going to go broke because of the rising sea levels. So using that analogy, who in the corporate world with power can citizens join? Would Netflix and Amazon be allies in this?
Well, you've seen that happen in earlier iterations of this debate. You've seen tactical alliances with Google and Netflix. And, you know, sometimes that makes strategic sense. But I think for the long term, that sometimes creates vulnerabilities in these coalitions because they often can play ball. There was one point when Google and Verizon did what was at that time called a gentleman's agreement, where they sort of cut a side agreement. This was a few years ago. But, you know, I think we have to be careful about that. And it's just important to remember that this is a democratic issue. This is about a social contract between internet companies, the government, and the public. And first and foremost, this has to be a social movement-driven campaign. So, yes, I think we should link up arms whenever it's strategically valuable with companies like Google. But at the same time, I think we have to have a longer-term project in mind.
So when will we know that we're being screwed? In other words, you know, when we go to what we want to get on the internet, it just takes forever and the traffic gets slowed down. And at the same time, whatever internet service provider you have, you know, which of the monopolies like Verizon and Comcast will be foisting all of their latest, you know, whatever on us. In other words, net neutrality has never been a very pungent kind of term. It's never had any kind of political heft to it. Mm-hmm. It's vague and amorphous. So it's not exactly a flag that you can rally around. And I don't think the public have been ever properly educated about what's at stake here. So they're going to have to find out the hard way. Is that the situation?
Well, I agree it's an unfortunate term, but I think we're stuck with it. Timothy Wu, of course, gave us this term. But what's often used as a kind of synonym for this is the open internet. And I think that gets more at what's at stake. That it would likely happen slowly so that maybe we wouldn't notice it right away. But without net neutrality protections, internet service providers have all kinds of perverse incentives to start slowing things down, maybe blocking things. I mean, I think that's when people will really start to freak out when particular kinds of content, maybe a political website gets blocked by, say, Comcast or Verizon. You know, this is where people will suddenly, I think, will be really alarmed. But in the meantime, it'll probably be subtle changes, and it might even seem like a consumer benefit at first, like, oh, certain types of content might not cut against your might not count against your data caps. So it could be sold as something that benefits consumers. But I think gradually we'll see the logic underlying the internet radically change. However, as I noted before, I'm optimistic that we don't get to this point. I think we can still hold the line here and protect net neutrality for the long term.
Well, just in closing, in many ways, you know, the internet has, even though it's revolutionized so much in terms of communications and commerce, it's nevertheless never really reached its potential as this extraordinary tool to educate and inform people. As we know from the last election, Facebook had been gamed by the Russians, etc. And in many ways, the internet and social media become a conduit for trivia as opposed to a font of information and education. So, in other words, the potential of this extraordinary tool has never been realized. And my sense is now, as it's becoming totally corporatized because of this FCC ruling today, we're going to basically drift away. Just to summarize it, Victor, my sense is that the challenge we face as American citizens is, are we going to be active citizens or passive consumers? And this decision will take us in the direction of being passive consumers, away from the possibility of being active citizens.
Yes, I worry about that. I think your assessment is spot on. At the same time, I think there still is this democratic potential with the internet, but we have to pass the right policies to bring that potential out. And I have a recent essay out called "The Misinformation Society" that looks at a number of these policy problems and policy interventions that we'll have to make as a society so that the internet does realize this democratic potential. But in the meantime, we just have to keep fighting for it. This is an activist issue, and I do think our democracy depends on it.
So where do people get this article you just mentioned?
I think if you Google Misinformation Society, but it's with Public Books. It was an essay that I wrote for them recently. But I just look at various media failures, policy failures behind those media failures, but also what we need to do to fix the problem.
Well, Victor Picard, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, who has been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the New America Foundation. And with Robert McChesney, he co-edited "Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights?" His latest book is "America's Battle for Media Democracy, the Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and the Future of Media Reform." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back in with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.